Hi, I'm Connor Iposi, Assistant Editor of HCP Live. Welcome to Doc Talk. As 2021 heads towards its final stretch, it is a great time to reflect on the year and the varying threads that tied it all together. From the constant battle against the COVID-19 pandemic to new advancements in almost every field of medicine, including endocrinology and diabetes. I recently spoke with Dr. Paul Gellinger, a professor of clinical medicine on the voluntary faculty at the University of Miami, as well as the private practice of endocrinology and diabetes at the Center for Diabetes and Endocrine Care in Hollywood, Florida. We discussed the release of new guidelines from the World Congress Insulin Resistance, Diabetes, and Cardiovascular Disease meeting earlier this month that may change the realm and scope of care when looking towards 2022. Dr. Gellinger was involved in the creation of those guidelines at the WCI-RDC entitled the DCRM Multi-Specialty Practice Recommendations for the Management of Diabetes, Cardiorenal, and Metabolic Diseases. The recommendations are soon to be published in the Journal of Diabetes and its Complications. His contribution was to the section of the DCRM on the treatment of lipid disorders, working on both the graphic and the text that accompanies each section. Dr. Gellinger outlined some of the included information, such as the LDL pathway to high-risk patients to extreme plus patients, or expected LDL decreases by agents such as statins or PCSK9s. Additionally, we discussed the role of the guidelines as not necessarily an encyclopedia for clinicians, but a useful tool for specialists of other fields who can refer to sections to see how other specialists are treating a condition, such as hypertension or cardiovascular disease. Even further, Dr. Gellinger chaired a discussion at the WCI-RDC meeting entitled Beyond LDL-C, the Role of Dyslipidemia in ASCVD. We discussed the talk's focus on the dyslipidemia section on new concepts in therapy, getting LDL back to goal, and of course, the talk's title, Beyond LDL. As well, the role of measuring Lp(a) and how combination therapy of high-intensity statins and other agents that are necessary to get to the LDL goal were discussed. Lastly, I spoke with Dr. Gellinger, looking forward to next year and the interrelation between diabetes and these other conditions that proves diabetes does not just exist in a vacuum. In fact, there are lingering effects that may shift the narrative of what treatment may entail. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Dr. Gellinger. Hi, Dr. Gellinger. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. Do you mind introducing yourself and giving just a little bit of background info into what you do?
Yes, my pleasure, and thank you for having me. My name is Paul Gellinger, and I'm in the private practice of endocrinology and diabetes at the Center for Diabetes and Endocrine Care in Hollywood, Florida. And I'm also a professor of clinical medicine on the voluntary faculty at the University of Miami. And I've been involved in the treatment of patients with diabetes, lipid disorders, and general endocrine issues for well over 40 years. And I've been very involved with the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, American College of Endocrinology, and actually chaired the committee that wrote the lipid guidelines for 2017. And I've been on the guideline committees for a number of diabetes guidelines as well.
To start off, obviously, you know, last week was the World Congress Insulin Resistance, Diabetes, and Cardiovascular Disease meeting. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the session you chaired entitled Beyond LDL-C, the Role of Dyslipidemia in ASCVD. So what did that session entail and what were some of the key highlights?
So the session on dyslipidemia was really focused on newer concepts in therapy, getting LDL down to goal and beyond LDL. And the first speaker was Dr. Ronald Krause. And Dr. Krause did a beautiful review, as he always does, of just what is going on in patients who have elevated triglycerides and low HDL, and just what the atherogenic dyslipidemia is all about. He was one of the first people to describe it many, many years ago. The elevation in serum triglycerides, the reduction in HDL, produces a very atherogenic lipid profile whereby the LDL becomes much more atherogenic because it's transformed into a small, dense particle. So when the triglycerides are elevated, HDL is low, the LDL particles become small and dense, and it's well known as small, dense LDL. And that particle is much more atherogenic than the normal size or large, buoyant LDL. It's much more atherogenic because it has a longer residence time in the arterial wall, and it promotes oxidation, et cetera, et cetera. And Dr. Krauss was really the first one that described this well over 20, 25 years ago, more than that even. And he keeps adding to our knowledge of this. It is very important to know that when triglycerides are elevated, the LDL configuration changes. And that happens at a triglyceride level of about 95, believe it or not, even though triglycerides are considered normal below 150. The change in the atherogenicity of LDL begins to appear when the triglycerides start to exceed 95. And when they're 120 and higher, there's a very substantial change in the configuration of LDL. So I asked, as the moderator, I asked Dr. Krauss the question, if at 95, the LDL becomes more atherogenic and harmful, where do we arrive at 150 as a guideline, as a goal across the board? And he indicated that was a compromise number that was decided on by those making that decision 25, 30, or even longer years ago. But it was agreed upon that above 95 was a point in which atherogenicity increases. But it was a compromise measure. It wasn't based on real science at that time, but it is where it stands today. The triglyceride goal is not 150 or less, but in fact, above 95, there is an issue where the LDL becomes more atherogenic. So keep the listeners to this, should keep that in mind, that in patients whose LDL is already elevated when the triglycerides exceed 95 and certainly over 120, that atherogenicity is increasing even beyond the level of LDL in that patient. So that was very, very important. He also discussed, that's one aspect of beyond LDL, the atherogenic risk introduced by the diabetic dyslipidemia or insulin resistance dyslipidemia of high triglycerides and low HDL. That's beyond LDL. That's sort of independent of LDL, but it makes LDL worse. The other factor that is beyond LDL is Lp(a), which is a very widely spoken about issue today. There are many, many clinical trials underway that are trying to produce a treatment for an elevated Lp(a). Lp(a) is an inherited protein that is prothrombotic and increases the clotting tendency in people who inherit this. It's strongly inherited in patients who have a family history of heart disease, and it is a very good thing to measure in people who have a strong family history of heart disease. And it's very commonly elevated. 20 to 25% of the population actually have an elevated Lp(a), and it should be looked at. Even though we don't have a specific drug to lower it, we know that patients who have an elevated Lp(a) need to have very aggressive LDL lowering to reduce the overall atherogenic milieu, even though we don't have a specific agent to lower Lp(a). But those trials are underway right now, and it's a very important topic. So patients who are at high risk or have a family history of heart disease, measuring an Lp(a) makes a great deal of sense because it's an additional risk that they've inherited and requires much more aggressive lowering of LDL to sort of neutralize that risk to an extent. The last thing he spoke about was the use of ApoB, or the measurement of ApoB, which is a sort of a refined measurement of LDL. It's what it's doing is measuring the ApoB protein that is on LDL, but also on other particles. But when you measure an ApoB, you're really getting a composite measure of all the atherogenic particles, not just LDL. So it has a better relationship to atherosclerosis than just LDL does. And there are patients who have LDLs that look reasonably normal who have high ApoB measurements because some of the other non-LDL proteins are attached to ApoB and are being measured, and they are atherogenic. So ApoB is an important measurement that not very expensive either, that should be done to, the way I use it, frankly, is when I believe I'm at my my patient's LDL goal, I then measure the ApoB to make sure I'm also at their ApoB goal, which is harder to achieve than the LDL goal because there are more particles involved. So when you think your LDL is less than 70, less than 55, and you've arrived at that and you think you're home free, so to speak, it's a good idea to look at ApoB because you may not be at an ApoB goal of less than 70 or less than 60. Those goals are published. And then you need to intensify your statin therapy or whatever therapy you're using to get the ApoB down below below that goal too. So that was a very useful. That's the way I use ApoB. That's not exactly what Dr. Krause said, but he does use it to refine his measurement of his LDL target to a degree as well. It's a very useful measurement, I find. The second presentation was by Dr. Aaron Mikos, and this was talking about using combination therapies for lowering LDL. And, you know, it was an overview of the whole LDL story, very nicely done, showing us that whether you look at genetic studies or clinical trial studies, randomized trials, prospective cohort studies, et cetera, the lower the LDL achieved throughout, no matter how you look at it, the better the outcome. So that's been well known. She showed a very nice graph, a chart that showed a straight line down to lower events as the LDL, the lower the LDL achieved. Whether you look at genetic Mendelian randomization studies or trial studies, lower is better. And that's no longer a hypothesis, which it was for a long time. It's really an axiom. The lower the LDL, the better for everyone. And it does not seem like there's a lower limit of LDL that doesn't benefit a patient. It keeps getting better and better as you go down to lower levels, and we're able to achieve very low levels now. And there doesn't appear to be any adverse reaction to very low LDL levels either, 20 or 30. But what she did mention is that LDL elevations are not only important for the height of the LDL is not only important, but the duration of exposure to someone for someone to have a high LDL is very important. So someone who has a mildly elevated LDL but has had that for 40 years or 30 years is at significant risk for coronary disease, perhaps even more than someone that has a much higher LDL that's only been detected in the last 5 or 6 years. So duration of exposure to a high LDL is very important in addition to the height of LDL. And it's been known that as you use statins to lower LDL, there's still a residual risk. Some of that residual risk of heart disease is what Dr. Krause spoke about, the dyslipidemia, the high triglycerides and low HDL, that really isn't always very well addressed. So that's part of the residual risk. But there is one possibility for the residual risk besides the diabetic or insulin resistance dyslipidemia that I just described and the presence of LP little a. Would be simply that we haven't been getting the LDL low enough. And that could be why there's a residual risk. That's certainly another theory. And she spoke about how low we can get it. And in combinations with high-intensity statins and ezetimibe, high-intensity statins and bempedoic acid, or combinations of statins, bempedoic acid, and ezetimibe, they really can lower LDL quite a bit. And if you can't get the LDL down to the 20s, 30s, or 40s using statins, ezetimibe, and bempedoic acid, we, of course, have the PCSK9 inhibitor drugs, the injectable drugs every 2 weeks, which are very robust. And they can be used in combination with statins, ezetimibe, or bempedoic acid. So there's really almost no excuse for not getting an LDL down to where it belongs. And the question is, where does it belong? And that's always been a little controversial, but the guidelines that many of us follow are not necessarily the ones that ACC/AHA produced in 2019. Actually, ACE in 2017 published lipid guidelines, the ones I was fortunate enough to chair, that established an extreme risk category with an LDL goal of less than 55 for people at extreme risk. A year or so later, the Europeans came out with their guidelines. They used exactly the same number, less than 55. They called those patients very high risk, not extreme risk. They also introduced another category of patients, extreme plus risk, so to speak, where if you had an event after being at extreme risk, if you had an event within the past 2 years, you're at extreme plus and you have an LDL goal of less than 40. So they went even farther than what ACE did. ACC/AHA is a little different. They talk about less than 70. Consider therapy below 70 in certain situations, but it's not quite as prescriptive as both the ACE and the European guidelines are. But the thing that came out of this talk was the need in many cases for combination therapy, from the get-go. And if your LDL is greater than 50% above goal to begin with, you really should start with two drugs, just like we do with diabetes and hypertension. And those two drugs can be, one should be a statin, the other could be an ezetimibe or bempedoic acid from the get-go. If the starting LDL is more than 50%, greater than the goal. And our goal in lowering LDL is two things. One is more than 50% from the baseline. And secondly, is to reach that goal. Are you extreme risk? Are you very high risk? Are you high risk? Whatever you fit into, you need to reach that goal and reduce the LDL by at least 50%. And the one you want to do is the lower of the two. If the LDL goal is less than 55, and that's more than reducing the LDL by 50%, you want to go to the LDL less than 55%. If reducing it by 50% is lower than an LDL of less than 55, you can do that. So she highlighted the combinations with various drugs. We're waiting for yet another drug called inclisiran, which is a twice a year injection that also inhibits PCSK9, which will lower LDL very, very substantially, like the PCSK9 inhibitors that are out today, but they work differently. But that's been held up with approval for a variety of reasons. Now, she also talked about adherence, and it's important to see patients regularly to get them to keep taking their medicines and to try to combine pills for adherence. And she showed many studies that show when you do that, you get better adherence. So that's the message, you know, is the lower the LDL, the better. Don't forget about the dyslipidemia, the high triglycerides and low HDL. Don't forget about ApoB. Start with combination therapy when you're more than 50% above your goal to begin with, and keep adding, here's the last point, keep adding your agents every 6 to 12 weeks and checking them every 6 to 12 weeks to get that patient to your goal, which often is less than 55 or certainly less than 70, and make certain you've lowered it by 50% as well. So that sort of is a overview of those two talks.
Very informative. I appreciate that, Dr. Jellinger. I was actually going to ask you a little bit about, sort of the onset of these new agents like the PCSK9 inhibitors, as opposed to only statins, and kind of what they represent and how have they been incorporated in your own clinical practice?
So the PCSK9 inhibitors are very powerful LDL lowering agents. And there were two major trials with each one of the two existing agents that showed a cardiovascular benefit. By lowering LDL down, it seemed to continue. The lower you went, the better, the more the benefit. They're very, very useful. Now, having said that, we have high intensity statins and we have ezetimibe and bempedoic acid. And if you combine two or three of those, statins with ezetimibe, statins with bempedoic acid, or statins with ezetimibe and bempedoic acid with a high intensity statin, you can actually drive the LDL well into the 40s many times. But there are some patients who can't tolerate those drugs for a variety of reasons, or continue to have cardiovascular progression despite getting the LDL down into the 50s or 40s and need an LDL of 20. And there's where the PCSK9 added to, you don't necessarily need the three drugs I just mentioned plus the PCSK9. You can get to these very low levels usually with a PCSK9 and a statin, or if they're intolerant to a statin, PCSK9 and ezetimibe, or PCSK9 and bempedoic acid. You can combine them, but it often isn't necessary. So they are reserved for patients who are intolerant to statins or where you cannot get to goal because of intolerance, because of or even if they're not intolerant, they're on maximum dose statin and ezetimibe. They're not at goal. Your goal is lower than where you are. Then the PCSK9 inhibitor is exactly where to go. And in terms of practice, it for a long time was extremely difficult to get into the hands of patients because of its cost. And frankly, the insurance companies would just present every possible barrier that could exist to make it difficult to get these patients on, which is sad to say, but we live in that world. The price did come down substantially a while back, and it is considerably easier, not automatic by any means, but you still have to make your case, so to speak, to the insurance company. But it is much easier to get a patient on a PCSK9, and they've been very, very useful.
Great. Yeah, a lot of great information coming from that meeting, especially. And I did want to talk to you a little bit about the DCRM multi-specialty practice recommendations and kind of ask you a little bit about, you know, what was your involvement in the recommendations and what do you think they represent overall?
Right. So some people think this was the highlight of the meeting, very honestly. So the DCRM multi-specialty practice recommendation was engineered and commandeered by Yehuda Handelsman, Dr. Handelsman, who also puts together this World Congress of Insulin Resistance, Diabetes and Cardiovascular Disease. And he felt in discussion with several of us that we needed a multi-discipline we needed multidisciplinary recommendations for how to manage the diseases we're all entrenched in every day. And DCM stands for Diabetes Cardiorenal Metabolic Disease. And of course, we know that, you know, these organs talk to each other and that nothing is in a vacuum. And patients with diabetes, you know, have heart disease and have kidney disease very significantly. And patients with kidney disease have heart disease. And heart failure is so common in diabetics. And now we're talking about the fatty liver as part of this as well. That's the metabolic end of it. So there's so many things that overlap that we felt it was, he pioneered this, that one source that was put together by, I'd say 30 or so voluntary authors from the various fields, nephrologists, cardiology, liver disease, diabetes, lipid disorders. It would put together a sort of a giant recommendation crossing all disciplines for the various aspects of these of disease states that fall into diabetes, cardiac, renal, and metabolic. And we produced this really, really, I must say, nice paper. The final tweaking is underway cosmetically, and I think we'll have in a day or so the actual online version of this. So my role, I contributed to the lipid section in the DCRM document, and I helped put together the graphic on the treatment of lipid disorders, much of which I have discussed already with you when I discussed the lipid section a moment ago, and also contributed significantly to the writing of the text that accompanies each slide. It's not meant to be an encyclopedic document. It's meant to be a useful document for primary care physicians and specialists, but not specialists in that field. So if you're an endocrinologist, you can look at the renal section and learn what the state-of-the-art people in renal disease think about how you should treat this renal, the renal component of this. If you're a nephrologist or if you're a liver person, you can look at how hypertension experts treat hypertension. It's all in here and beautifully laid out. And if you have, you know, if you're a diabetes specialist, you can look and across the board and see how the cardiologists are managing and how they're viewing the cardiovascular disease associated with diabetes and pre-diabetes, et cetera. It's a really broadly encompassing document, very nice, I have to say, very nicely put together. Again, not an encyclopedic guideline, but a useful tool for primary care specialists and specialists of other fields, not specifically in this particular document. And it does, however, it's why I say it's not extremely comprehensive. It's comprehensive enough, and it gives a great deal of guidance as to how to approach patients with hypertension, with heart failure, with renal disease, with cardiovascular disease, with diabetes, the issue of hypoglycemia, fatty liver, issues of compliance and patient education. All that is there, and there are many, many tips, so to speak, and much guidance to physicians in this document. So I don't want to minimize how useful it is. It's not a 200-page guideline, but it's a very useful tool for the physicians that I mentioned that's appropriate. And, you know, there's just so much in this document, it would take 2 hours to go through it. But, you know, the very nice graphic on prediabetes and how it's a continuum of cardiorenal metabolic risk, and even a section on cognitive dysfunction in these patients and how to manage it, even vaccination. On the left side of the lipid slide, the lipid graphic is the LDL pathway from high-risk patient to extreme plus, that I mentioned before, from a goal of less than 100 in LDL down to less than 40 in extreme risk, and defining who comprises each one of those categories. Who's in high risk, who's in very high risk, who's in extreme risk, and extreme risk is a very important category because that was the new one that was introduced by ACE in 2017 that really set the bar for everyone and for everyone else. And the Europeans followed a year later with the exact same goal. And then the extreme plus is less than 40 if you had an event in the past 2 years and you're already at extreme risk. That was introduced by the Europeans. So there is that goal. It's that arrow down and that pathway down to less than 40. But what's important about the left side of this graphic is the definition of who's at high, very high, and extreme risk, and who's at extreme plus. That's what's going to come into everyday practice. And on the is also some tables about expected decreases in LDL by the various agents that we have, the statins, PCSK9, ezetimibe, bempedoic acid, and the combinations. On the right side of the graph is the management of hypertriglyceridemia, elevated triglycerides, which, you know, has always been a little more complicated than the LDL story. But what we have done on this is divided into two sections. One is, are you managing hypertriglyceridemia to reduce the risk of ASCVD, heart disease, and stroke? Or are you managing hypertriglyceridemia to reduce the risk of pancreatitis? Because those are the two issues at hand with triglycerides. And it guides you through, you're using omega fish oil, eicosapentaethyl, if your patient has ASCVD or has diabetes and two risk factors for heart disease, the way the REDUCE-IT trial, the cohort of the REDUCE-IT trial, you add eicosapentaethyl, but everyone should be on a statin and a low fat, moderate carbohydrate diet, and consider adding a fibrate or niacin as well. But that's for the ASCVD. For the risk of pancreatitis, where the patient isn't at cardiovascular risk particularly, they still should be on a statin because the statins lower triglycerides, and of course a low-fat, moderate carbohydrate diet. But there, the use of eicosapentaethyl, omega-3 fish oil, is not specific to IPE because eicosapentaethyl has been shown to reduce cardiovascular events, and others haven't, but they all lower triglycerides. So if your patients have elevated triglycerides greater than 500, you can use any fish oil, also fibrate or niacin, and consider adding pioglitazone, an insulin sensitizer, and maybe even insulin in patients with severe hypertriglyceridemia. So that's a nice slide. Similar slides are there for controlling blood pressure and a stepwise addition of the various agents there, principles of anticoagulation, antiplatelet therapy, the treatment of diabetes, antihyperglycemic therapy. You know, we used to say, and we still do, that metformin is the first drug for everybody. And after that, well, take your pick. Well, what came out of this conference and what also came is woven into the DCRM document is that we need to look beyond glycemia. And even in patients whose A1C is very favorable, we should be looking at metformin plus something else from the get-go, even if they don't need it for glycemic control, because we now know the GLP-1 receptor agonists and make a nice impact on reducing cardiovascular disease, and the SGLT2 inhibitors, oral medications, make a substantial impact in reducing the presence of heart failure, congestive heart failure, and they reduce the number of instances of heart failure, plus they reduce cardiovascular death. So you have diabetic patients who are very prone to both cardiac events and heart failure. We have these two agents. One reduces cardiovascular events, the GLP-1 receptor agonists, generally given by injection, or there is one oral form. The other is oral SGLT2 that makes a substantial impact on reducing heart failure. And most diabetics are prone to both those situations, cardiovascular disease and heart failure. So you really ought to think when you're starting your patient on just metformin, why shouldn't they be on either an SGLT2 or GLP-1 receptor agonist? You don't necessarily need to do that in every patient, because there are some 45-year-old type 2 diabetics who don't really are not at risk for heart disease at that time and are not at risk for heart failure. And you can focus on glycemia, at least for a time being, with those patients. But there are many patients who may have a high calcium score or may have a bad family history of heart disease or an unfavorable lipid profile, where you may want to start with a GLP-1 receptor agonist as well as metformin because of its benefit in terms of cardiovascular disease. Or if that patient is already showing evidence of possible heart failure, early heart failure, pre-heart failure, so to speak, using an SGLT2. So we're in a new world of looking at things, at issues beyond glycemia, looking at the cardiovascular benefits of these agents. And they reduce stroke and they reduce heart failure, they reduce coronary events, along with metformin from the beginning in selected patients. And what I didn't mention was kidney failure. The SGLT2s also have a strong impact on reducing the progression of kidney failure. Diabetics get kidney failure. They get it to a significant degree. It's important to check urinary creatinine to albumin ratios to detect that very early. That came up at the meeting, and it's also in this paper. But once you have any albuminuria or any evidence that the GFR is declining, the use of an SGLT2 inhibitor right from the get-go with metformin was very, very sensible, because several studies with the SGLT2 inhibitors have shown that they slow significantly the progression of loss of renal function, which is common in diabetes. So you've got someone whose GFR has declined, is it reduced already? They don't need it for glycemia, but they may need it for protecting that kidney and stopping the decline in kidney function. So these are really important concepts. So combination therapy in diabetes is becoming an important concept as well, because of these non-glycemic benefits. Know your patient. Is this patient predisposed to heart failure? Has a declining GFR? Is a history of ASCVD, or already on their way to ASCVD, or has had an event? You need to use these agents in combination with metformin, maybe someday even in place of metformin. But it needs to be considered. Cost is a factor, but it turns out that most insurance policies, most insurances do cover these agents reasonably well. And it's not often that we see cost not allowing the patient to at least begin these therapies. Sometimes that will be the case, and of course in the non-insured patient for certain. So it's a sort of a quick and dirty tour of this DCRM. At the end of the paper, by the way, is a very, very comprehensive table of all the agents that can be used for treating kidney disease, hypertension, antiplatelet therapy, anticoagulation, diabetes, lipid disorders, a full list of all the agents and their properties, their adverse reactions, their benefits, and their risks, all in one big table, which is by itself an incredible amount of information. It's the last slide in the slide deck. So spoken a lot about lipids, but the same thing can be spoken about with hypertension and glycemia, which I have spoken about, and coagulation and cardiovascular. And there's so many aspects to this paper. It's really Herculean is the term, and encyclopedic. Well worth reading by primary care physicians, specialists in other areas that are not dealing with this, and easy to read. Beautiful graphics with a succinct and clear text that goes along with it.
very comprehensive, covered a lot of things that were important. Kind of brings me to my next question, which is, you know, it's December, it's the end of the year. This is, you know, an important thing. You know, what's next for this larger diabetes and cardio renal space? What's coming next year in 2022?
It's a good question. I don't know. Don't pretend to have a real crystal ball. I think that, you know, we want to get the international community more involved in this. And that would be one thing that would be very useful. And there's going to be new trials and new outcome data that is going to emerge in the next year or two in a number of areas that have to be included. This document's a live document, a living document, and will be updated as frequently as reasonable. But we're going to have, first of all, I mentioned the Lp(a) trials. They will be concluded in a few years, and we'll have information on drugs that can lower Lp(a). But there'll be more outcome trials with SGLT2 inhibitors, kidney disease, heart failure, all that we've been talking about. There's some new GLP-1s, more information on kidney disease. We have another class of drugs, the mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists, which I didn't speak to, and there's one new one just released. Maybe there'll be some others. It's hard, and new technologies. I mean, what's going on with the insulin pumps and self-monitoring of glucose is really astounding, and that's going to get more not only affordable but more accurate and it is quite accurate now, but more on board for the average patient. I'm hoping to see that continuous glucose monitors will be easy for patients with type 2 diabetes to acquire. It's a little bit of a challenge now with the insurance companies because they want patients who take insulin 3 times a day and things like that. But CGM, continuous glucose monitoring, is extremely useful in type 2 diabetes as well, and is improves A1C all by itself just by knowing what your sugars are without even changing the therapies. So there's a lot of things coming down the line. I think the quick answer to what's the future is incorporating all the new studies which are going to emerge, and fatty liver. There'll be a number of studies on fatty liver in the next few years, incorporating all that information into this living document.
Absolutely. That's great. That about wraps it up. Is there anything else you think would be important to mention?
No, but just appreciate the fact that diabetes doesn't live in a vacuum. It affects the kidney, it affects the heart, and in many ways, it affects the liver, fatty liver, and is associated tightly with elevated blood pressure. And they all interrelate so significantly that's the basis of this multidisciplinary publication that we just did. But also the sessions that we had at the World Congress were very useful reviews about the importance of combination therapy, getting LDLs down, and recognizing the residual risk beyond LDL, which we have to deal with in the next tier, no question.
My thanks to Dr. Jellinger for joining me to discuss some pretty big advancements in the field of endocrinology and diabetes, especially highlighting the importance of the DCRM and what is coming next in 2022. If you are looking for more engaging audio content, check out other episodes of Doc Talk or our specialty-specific podcast series, including Lungcast, hosted by the American Lung Association, Derm Discussions, hosted by practicing dermatologist Dr. Brad Glick, and Heartbeats with Dr. Manish Patel from Duke University. Visit our website at hcplive.com and check out our Diabetes and Endocrinology Condition Center pages. And subscribe to our email newsletter to keep up with all the clinical news and expert insights the HCP Live team is covering on the site. As always, follow us on social media, on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. I'm Connor Iposi. Thanks for listening to Doc Talk.